Hi, and welcome to SpondyCast, where we bring together the best medical minds, thought leaders, scientists, patients, and caregivers to inform and inspire the spondylitis community. I'm your host, Jill Miller, living my best spa life, knowing that how we meet today has the power to change everything going forward. Please note that the information provided in this podcast should not be considered medical advice. We do encourage all listeners to consult their healthcare professionals for medical concerns. Thank you for listening, and we hope you find our discussion today enlightening.
Welcome to the 100th episode of SpondyCast. Today, we are flipping the script. I'm Michael Pianin, Board Chair of the Spondylitis Association of America. And for this very special milestone episode, I'll be stepping into the interviewer seat. Our usual host, Jill Miller, will be sharing her story, her journey with spondyloarthritis, her experiences hosting this incredible podcast, and some of her favorite moments from the last 99 episodes. Jill has been a guiding voice for our community, and today we get to hear her personal insights and her reflections. This episode is From Host to Guest, celebrating 100 episodes with Jill Miller. Let me tell you a little bit about Jill. Jill is a sought-after speaker and an advocate for resilience, impact-driven leadership, and redefining success. Diagnosed with chronic illness, she turned her experience into the Chronically Ambitious Blueprint, a framework for cultivating self-connection, authentic relationships, and leading with love. She is the founder and CEO of Lunum, a human capital impact platform reshaping how businesses value their workforce. Jill is a member of the U.S. Department of State's International Exchange Alumni Community. She has been honored as the 2024 Innovator of the Year, Empowering Women in Industry, the 2022 Women Doing It Big, and a 2024 Her Story Maker. She serves on multiple boards, including the Spondylitis Association of America, and hosts SpondyCast, a podcast on resilience and chronic illness. She was featured on the New York Stock Exchange Floor Talk and in the Chicago Tribune. Jill delivers powerful insights that inspire transformation in business and in life. So hi, Jill. Welcome to your own podcast.
Hi, this is really weird. How are you, Michael?
We're all interested in you, and can you share your personal journey with spondyloarthritis? When were you diagnosed? And what was that experience like for you?
I love hearing everybody else's stories. But yeah, mine was, it started as a teenager, where I just had a lot of these moments medically where no one could explain what was going on, but a lot of them were related to back and gut and heel pain and neck pain. I'd been in a lot of physical therapy with really no explanation. A lot of like upper GIs and all that. And everybody just said, nope, there's nothing wrong with you. Nothing on the films. And in 2011, I took a tumble on ice in winter in January in Indiana. And I had a concussion and some other, musculoskeletal injury, but that was getting, it should have been getting better, and it wasn't getting better. It was getting worse and worse and worse. And by 2012, I actually changed jobs because I was so miserable and so fatigued. And everyone just kept saying, like, you're fine. You should be fine. Everything should be fine. But I was so sick. I had two little kids. I couldn't pick up my kids. I couldn't lift them. And by 2013, I was barely getting out of bed like 3 hours a day, and eventually stopped working. And in that time, that two and a half years, I had been to, I don't even know, I'd been to a naturopath, I'd been to a pain doc, I'd been to an, what I would call an integrative doc, which I don't think was the greatest, like most experienced integrative doc. I'd just been through the gamut. And like most of the listeners and people I've talked to on this podcast, there was a lot of like, well, you have fibromyalgia, or there's nothing wrong with you, or you're nuts, or like, here's just another pain pill. And by 2013, I was also on like a number of medications, which was horrendous. And someone finally said to me, they said, have you seen a rheumatologist? And that changed my life. And I went to see Dr. Arnold, who we've talked about a lot on this podcast. And I went to her office and she came in and she said, tell me everything. And we spent the next it was almost 2 hours by the time we did blood work. And she said, I think it's either spondylitis or psoriatic arthritis. And we're going to do some blood tests. We're going to figure it out. You're not crazy. And then we're going to make you better. And 2 weeks later, she walked into the office and looked at me and she said, she actually, her eyes welled up with tears. I tell this story in the episode where I interviewed her. And she said, you have spondylitis, and I know what this means for a mother your age, and we're going to help you get better. So I'll never forget that day, even though I couldn't say axial spondyloarthritis.
So it's hard to say and it's hard to live with.
I know. Yes.
How has living with this disease shaped your perspective on your life, your work, your family? How has it shaped the way you look at the world?
So it's interesting because you met me in 2020, I think, when I was on the other side of a lot of it. But shortly after diagnosis, I had reached out to SAA. And once I started feeling better, I started with a support group, which I found I wasn't like overly, I wasn't very good at support groups, but that's another story. And Gail, who runs the support group in Chicago, she's just my hero. But we ran some of that together and that was super helpful. And in 2017, I started to feel like myself again. And when I say feel like myself again, I don't actually think I was living as an adult until that point, because I'd felt miserable from 17 to almost 40. And I had good times, bad times, but like overall, I don't think I actually figured out what I was capable of as an adult until probably 2018, 2019. And it's interesting because as I started to feel like me again, the gloves came off. And by the time you met me, we'd met when we were both in Germany. We had a lot of conversations there. And part of what I think about a lot with SAA is there are a lot of people that say that our disease is not tragic enough to draw huge interest. And the more and more I think about it and the more I get involved and as I've done Spondycast, what I have realized is this disease prohibits dreams from being realized. And that to me is probably how it's changed my perspective in a wanting to like help people and share about it, but also realizing and giving myself some grace for like some of the things in my life previous. And I lean on a lot of you guys. You're like my tribe. Say, hey. So I think it's really shaped me into like living where I don't think I was there before.
So early on, it's an invisible disease.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you looked wonderful and the people around you didn't know what you were going through.
Yeah.
What were some of the biggest challenges that you faced in those early years? And how did you navigate them?
Yeah, I think it was, for me, it was really, was the thing with the things with my kids, right? Not being able to get out of bed or be at every, okay, I'm not going to say every soccer game, et cetera, because I never wanted to be at every soccer game. The important things. And I remember a day when one of my daughters walked in the room and said, my teacher asked me if we could do this. And I said, I can't because I have a sick mom. And that was probably one of the hardest times, like those couple of years trying to get better when we were like with little kids, and just the pain. And I think people don't get the heaviness of some of the pain and fatigue associated with this disease. And that was like, that was another challenge, was just the social part. I'm obviously very social, and there was a lot to navigate there, where as you start to fall off, then your friends go away, or as you don't, you know, you people don't understand why you can't show up for things. It was really tough. And I think just the understanding of people around me, and I, at the same, like in 2013, I left work. I was in very bad shape when I left work and didn't want to discuss it or tell people or share it. So it became, it's like, it became, I've talked about this on a couple episodes, where it becomes almost like we almost shame ourselves into something because we have the disease. And that was hard, because you don't want to talk about people. You don't want to be the sick person. That was really hard for me. I took a lot of self-reflection and like strength building to get back into it.
So you lived with a secret.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember telling my boss the first time, like probably right around early 2020. And I told him, we were sitting at a bar, like in like Detroit or something. And I said, Mark, I got to tell you something, because I feel like I've been lying to you for 2 years. And I told him, and he was gracious. And he was like, what he said was, I respected you before and I respect you more now. He said, but it makes me understand why you'd always get up and roam around the room and in conference calls, why you did certain things. And he said, and I've seen you a couple times where you're just great, and then you fall off like at the end of the day. And I was like, yeah, I think that's a lot of it. So, but it is. Yeah. Did you feel that too? The living like a secret at all? Sorry to throw it back on you. I can't help it.
Now, our stories are very similar.
Yeah.
Because I was raising a child alone. And it certainly was a secret.
Yeah.
You know, especially for me in court, I couldn't let anybody know that I was in pain or sick. No one cared. The juries didn't care and the courts didn't care. Yeah. But I think that's endemic and appropriate for spondylitis.
Yeah.
You know, that we go through that. But I'm more interested in you.
Okay.
Today. So one of the questions I have for you, you've done, this will be the 100th episode, which is
crazy.
Epic.
It is epic.
What have been some of the most memorable or impactful moments for you as a host of Spondycast?
Wow. Okay. I made a list. Because there were, you guys asked two questions. One was, what are the most memorable and what are the favorites? And they all kind of fall into the same bucket. I would say one of them, the most emotional one, was Dr. Forty, who is someone who has spondyloarthritis and has spent his life and his life's work studying fatigue with people in spondyloarthritis. Fatigue has probably been my most significant symptom. I remembered I was crying a lot during the episode, because the way he described fatigue was the first time I'd heard someone describe fatigue the way he articulated it, the exact same way I would have if I could find the words. And I am sure that other people felt that too. I actually remember some of the things he said. I remember closing my laptop and going in my room and crying like for 2 hours afterwards. Just the magnitude of what he talked about and how it was affecting me at the time. I would say that another one that was really standout was Sarah Loudon. And forgive me, Sarah, because she does work with a number of like medical groups. She's an entrepreneur, and listening to her and her like spirit and her journey in entrepreneurland, I very much resonated with her. A lot of the work ones, right? Like a lot of the ones related to work are, I'm kind of obviously a workaholic, as you've all figured out. One of my absolute favorites that came to life in a real way was Kurt and Grant Rocha, who do the Capital Cup every year, and they donate back what they win to spondyloarthritis. They're just two great, amazing humans, a father and son team. And I had the sincere honor of driving the beer cart last fall during the Capital Cup with Cassie. And then there are people who I feel like they are, there are a couple people who like, I feel like they've become friends. Jana Lomax, I love, like that woman I love. She's a psychologist, and I first came across her in 2018 at the Denver support group leaders meeting. And when we started Spondycast, one of my first requests was somebody go find that woman that talked about how to prevent a chronic disease from becoming, or an acute flare from becoming a chronic flare. And we've had her on a couple times. Afton Hassett, who is at University of Michigan, and we've done a number of, I've been on her podcast now. She is this woman who has dedicated her life to pain and the understanding of pain and resilience factors in pain management. She runs the, I'm going to get this wrong, but the Chronic Pain and Opioid Center at Michigan. And it made me realize reading her book. I remember I was reading her book, which is called The Chronic Pain Reset. It's an amazing book. I think it's like, it should be a New York Times bestseller. But I had been traveling for like 6 weeks straight, and I came home and I was going to interview her the following week. I came home one day and I was exhausted, and there was a box waiting for me, and I tore it open, and there it was, her book. And I like dove right into it, and I was like, oh, this is going to fix me. Afton was amazing. Iris Sink, our sex therapist, was awesome. Would totally have her on again. I think that's a really important topic that we don't talk about, that again is like sort of a taboo. The menopause episode will go down in history as one of my favorite for sure. We've had so many amazing guests. Like, I know that's like five. One of my favorites is like the stories of resilience, like Helgi. Those are right. This is where we find our people, and sometimes the motivation and inspiration and motivation to like step it up. Like, I'm always amazed. People tell me I do a lot, and I turn around, I look at somebody like Helgi who runs a 300-mile marathon. Like, there's no way, right? Those I guess would be the top. But there are so many, all the food ones. I can go on forever.
Well, you can if you wish.
Okay. I think there is also, there was this theme. As you know, everybody knows, I think I always talk about data. on Spondycast, and I'm fascinated by the number of conversations we've had that fall into certain buckets. And I started looking at them a little differently. Have you seen Blue Zones?
Of course. This
documentary? Yeah. I started classifying them as like the Blue Zones for AS. of the 100 episodes we've done. And we've, right, because the Blue Zones, for anybody who doesn't know, is a, his name's Dan Bittner. And he was a professional cyclist. He cycled all over the world. And he wanted to figure out, he wanted to solve one big problem in the world, I think is the way he talks about it. And what he started to realize, there was a pattern to certain areas of the world where people live to be over 100 most frequently. And I resonated a lot with him when I started watching it, because he, you see him and he talks about, he goes, and there's this place in Japan where all these people live to be over 100. And he goes, and I thought, that is a problem worth looking into. Like, that is a solution worth looking into. And so the Blue Zones, I know you can quiz me, but I probably won't remember all of the areas. And there are five areas in the world. One's in Greece, Costa Rica, in one of the poorest areas of Costa Rica. The other one is
in Okinawa.
What's that?
Okinawa.
Okinawa, Japan. That's right. The purple sweet potatoes. Which I have in my fridge. So it was Okinawa, Costa Rica, Japan, or Okinawa, Costa Rica, Greece, Italy, and one is Loma Linda, California, right? Which was, blew me away. And I watched Blue Zones, I don't know when it came out, but I watched it after we interviewed a few doctors from Loma Linda University and the integrative medicine group there. And I, well before I watched Blue Zones, I can remember saying, you know, you guys are like my favorite doctors, because you talk about all the stuff that I love, which is like sleep and eat right, and, you know, what are you putting in your mind and what are you putting in your body? And as it turns out, right, the Blue Zones are the right outlook, the right food. And by the way, I've started using the one for the 80% rule. So stop eating when you're 80% full. Connection with human beings and strong social networks and a sense of belonging. And I do think there is this like find your tribe thing. I'll come back to. And then there's like move all the time. And all the people in the Blue Zones move every day, and they do things like walk and they garden and they do manual tasks. But some of these, like, they're 100 years old and they're moving like mad. The connection one, I think for a lot of us with spondylitis, is a hard one, even for as outgoing as I am. It has been a long time and a hard road to find like what I'd call my tribe. And I think one of the things that I love about Spondycast is I hear from people who tell me about, you know, listening or getting connected with SAA, and that they do find that we are their tribe and that we understand them. So that's really important to me. But yeah, I think the four themes I came up with were right, medical treatment and diagnosis. We had many episodes that consistently addressed the journey and the evolving landscape, which I think is really important, breakthroughs, medications, and the treatments to begin with. We went through all of those. We did holistic and integrative wellness, which is probably my favorite, right? This is a lot of, well, it's probably in my top three of four. But we did a lot of like non-pharma approaches for overall well-being. And I know there were times we did some really like, my rheumatologist calls them woo-woo. She's like, we're going to try something woo-woo, which might be something that isn't researched, but it won't hurt you, or it could improve your mood. And some of those were interesting. Like there were a couple on like grounding, and grounding was really interesting to me. I had never thought about it. And then I realized at that point, I probably hadn't been like outside touching grass for like 4 weeks, because I'd been like airports and hotels and elevators. Sandra Voss was amazing. Our our earliest yogi. We did a whole pranayama breathing class, which I'm a big fan of. Let's see, we did massage, physical therapy. Alex Levine is the best. He's awesome. He's also got spondylitis, or I should be saying spondyloarthritis to be appropriate. But it was like, this was all like stress reduction, rebalancing, mental health. Then we got into nutrition a lot, and there was an obvious through line there. Was like nutrition, gut health, and inflammation management. And more, even the last few years, I find that like when I eat the foods that are known to cause inflammation, like sugar and booze and lots of gluten, highly processed foods, I feel worse. So I'm going to say that's like enough evidence for me to kind of stay on the side of a healthier diet. But those are like, we've got into gut biome, which was fun, I think, with Dr. Rosenbaum. The microbiome, I think, is the future. I think there's, right, I'm beginning to believe we have three guts. One is our heart, our head, and our gut. We did Ayurveda, which was awesome, with my Ayurvedic person, Lori Beth. Nutrient depletion was one. We did two. I can go on for hours, and then, but overall, food is a common thread throughout the management of this disease. And then community, right? And I think that was the personal stories again, like going back to Helgi, and I'm going to forget the name of the weightlifter. That's not going to come to me. But the other thing was advocacy. Like that really came through. And we'll talk about that a little more, I think, down the road. But the advocacy and policy is going to be huge for us, particularly in the U.S., I think, and in developed countries over the next few years. It's been a journey. Sorry.
So one of the things you brought up, and it was in the Blue Zone analysis, is community. And you've brought it up a number of times. So one of the, in the scientific articles regarding chronic pain, whether it be from spondyloarthritis or other chronic pain diseases, isolation, social isolation, and family isolation are one of the big problems people have faced. Have you faced that? And if you did, how have you worked on that? And how have you gotten over that concept of isolation?
So, as I said, there were several years where I really didn't interact with many people outside of like my very nuclear family. And I went from being super social to almost, I wouldn't call myself a recluse, but like very isolated from my people. I wasn't traveling, et cetera. Somehow I found a way out of that. And really it was telling myself I was going to find my way out and that Superman wasn't coming and I had to like really do this and I had to do it for my kids. And I think I almost did it on autopilot in the beginning. And it was like getting back and going to the gym, going back into the workforce was big after a few years off. But it was forcing myself and truly asking myself like if I was going to cancel something because I didn't feel good was like, am I going to cancel this because I don't feel good and I'm not going to be able to go to work tomorrow? Am I canceling it? I could probably do it, but I should go ahead and do it. And there was a lot of self-talk in that. And I really began, I think I personally, and I'm sure a lot of other people, I personally began to push the limits of what I thought were the boundaries of the disease for me personally, where I was at in my journey on the disease. And I will tell you with high degree of certainty. So if you recall, like when we first met in Germany at that summit, it was two weeks before COVID started.
Right.
And I came back to the US on March 1. I'd been in the Louvre the last day it was open. I was home for 3 days and then I went to Denver for work, and I was in Denver for like 5 days. And one of my kids called me and she was hysterical. She had probably like my reaction to school being closed down and all those things. Jumped on a plane home and there was already no toilet paper left in the world. And my first reaction when the world was like overjoyed for the most part of like, whoo, we got 2 weeks of not going into the office and we've got this. And my first response was, I am not staying in this apartment for 2 weeks or 2 days. I am going to do everything I can to find an excuse to get out of this place. Because if I have to be cooped up in my house for 2 weeks, which turned into what, like 8 months, I am going to jump out a window. Like, and I remember having that thought like by March 15th of 2020, like, I am not doing this again. I have been isolated before. I didn't know if I could survive it. And in fact, when I was working, I was working in the agricultural sector at the time. And we did have customers who were delivering product to grocery store shelves. So I raised my hand every time we had an angry customer, like, I'll go. You guys need somebody to go? I'll go. Put me on a plane, put me in a car. I remember driving from Chicago to Nebraska and I could not find a place with an open bathroom in a single day. It was horrendous. And it gave me, being like on the immunocompromised side was really like I can tell you my rheumatologist was freaking out. She did not like what I was doing. And it cost me, it penalized me and like not being able to get my meds sometimes, but I feel like my mental health survived and I survived. I mean, I didn't get COVID till like late 22 for the first time. But I think it goes to like what we put in our heads can also like what we're thinking can also, affect us. And I think there's also like a lot of us stop moving, which is not good for this disease. Yeah, I was just terrified. So getting out of it was just sheer will, I think, in 2017, 18, and coming back into the world. And I also found I have a whole new outlook on the people that I spend time with. And I'm really grateful for that. And I probably now am whatever the opposite of isolated is, because I'm never home. And that's okay too.
I'd like to take you back a little bit. So you said that it was 2013 mm-hmm. that you were, was that when you were diagnosed?
Yeah.
Okay. So in the time right before you were diagnosed, were you active before you started having the symptoms of spondyloarthritis? Were you physically active?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I was never like, I'd call myself a gym rat these days, more so than I ever was before spondylitis. But I was active and I did stuff and for many years leading up to it, I kept a 50 to 70% travel schedule where I was hauling around cameras. I sold industrial cameras at the time. So I'd carry about 70 to 100 pounds of luggage anywhere I went, throwing them in the car and, you know, driving 40, 50,000 miles a year. Had two little kids, ran around like a crazy person, like moms do with two little kids. I did gym stuff and walked but not to the extent that I cared about good form and being really active that I do today.
So my question really went to the period where you started getting the more significant symptoms.
Yeah.
Where, I mean, I don't know your experience, my experience was I was having trouble walking. So I was an athlete.
Yep.
So all the activity I had done before ceased.
Yep.
And I became inactive.
Yep.
Because it hurt.
Yes.
Did you experience that? Did you go through that period?
Yeah, I did. And I'd had what I would look back for 20 some years as flares leading up to that. But I got to a point where it did become chronic and I stopped moving as much. My back and my hips and my knees and everything, and it got progressively worse, right? And now we know, like, because the less we move, the more progressively worse a lot of the stiffness gets. But yeah, I stopped. I walked with a cane for a few years. I could barely hold up my weight. And then you start to, like, for me, I started to lose like muscle mass, which wasn't great. My fingers like had a lot of grip strength issues. Just, yeah, general, and that like general overall misery that sometimes comes with this disease of everything. For me, it's like everything's on fire.
So how did you overcome that? Did you start activity even though it hurts?
Yeah.
Or were you given some medications that ameliorated some of the discomfort?
Yeah. So
able to do more.
Yeah. So it was a few things over a couple of years for sure. When I got diagnosed in 2013, we tried one biologic, then a second biologic. Eventually moved to a third. The second was working great, but we needed more of it and insurance didn't agree. So it was probably 2014. I actually started a little dog walking business in my neighborhood where I would walk cute little dogs and just far enough where they weren't too far from my house to keep me moving. But I wasn't really strength training at that point. When I really saw the shift was when I started seeing an Ayurvedic person and started doing a program. It was Lori Beth, who we've had on a couple of times. I started into more Ayurvedic eating. This is when I changed my food. I call it like gluten limited is the word I use because I never went completely gluten free, but that helped significantly and it helped all my gut issues. At that time, I also was like onto the third biologic. Was also on a lot of medications and slowly, like as I saw Lori Beth and was doing Pilates and gyrotonic and eating differently, I started to see I didn't need the medications. And eventually, like after it took about a year and a half, almost 2 years, to the point where I was off all the medications. At that time, I also, my doctor walked in the room one day and she looked at me and she said, your biggest problem isn't spondylitis, it's that you smoke. And until you quit smoking, we're not going to be friends. I quit smoking and I was already on the upswing, but that like gave me for sure. I mean, like, and I've now read all the literature. I went through the Mayo smoking cessation program with a person who can treat. The literature, right, is very clear about inflammation when you smoke. So that was huge. But yeah, it was a very slow, I feel like it was over several years. And there was a day like in the spring of 17. And if I look back, I could find it. It was the very first time I ever listened to a podcast. I can remember standing in the bathroom, listening to the podcast, getting ready to go out for my birthday. It was the first time I'd felt really good in like a couple of years. I was like 42, 43 at that point. And then there were a couple more of those moments and a couple more and a couple more. And I really, at that moment, I was like, what am I feeling when all this is happening? What is going on in my life when I'm starting to feel like myself And I started like collecting the data around what made me feel better. And I started doing more of that. And I even remember at the time I was on methotrexate, and I said to my doctor, I was like, I think I need to go back to being able to drink. I don't need my liver checked every three weeks or whatever it was. But I just disliked being, you know, so like going back to being social, but not being able to like be social with everyone else. And it was a lot. It was a million little steps that all added up to feeling better. And it was consistent. And it was, I think a lot of it was showing up on the days where I felt really bad and didn't want to, and just keeping going.
So you've dedicated a large part of your life to spondylitis, helping people with spondylitis. So I'm going to ask you a really unfair question.
Okay.
For the person who's just been diagnosed, whether they're 17 or 35, but they've had trouble, now they've just been diagnosed, they have a name to their pain, what specific advice would you give them as to, this is the start of their new journey, what advice would you give them that you think would be valuable to them?
Yeah, I think it's four things. I think it's, remember that if you have your health, you have many problems. If you do not have your health, you have only one problem, which is to solve the way to getting your health back. I believe for many of us, there's always a spectrum of the disease. And I have a lot of empathy for anyone at all on the spondyloarthritis road. But I think there are a number of times when I have met people and I have encouraged them to push, and they say they can't push, and we get going and they push a little harder. And I'm kind of tough love, I think, when it comes to this stuff, but I think you have to push hard. And I think that's, you know, the part about stealing yourself for a journey. Like, you have, the word warrior is like real when it comes to spondylitis, right? And it's, how do you prepare yourself for that journey? What I have experienced and have seen a number of people experience is that it may get worse before it gets better. As your immune system is so depleted, and then you start getting these drugs into you, and they can wreak havoc on all kinds of different parts of your life and your skin. And you went from like never having the flu to all of a sudden you get every time someone sneezes, you've got pneumonia. I think that there's ultimately, the goal is, right, you have to, I believe life is hard. And if you have an option to choose your hard, that's much better than not having the option. And I think especially for young people getting ahead of it, I also would say if you don't feel heard by your doctor, or your medical team, you need to find a new doctor. That's really, really, really important. And I think as a patient community, we have to challenge our providers at times just as much as they challenge us. We are the only people who will advocate for ourselves better than anyone else. And I know we've actually had some episodes on this where you may want to toss it off to someone in your circle to come in and help you with that. But advocating for yourself is, I think, one of the most critical pieces. And I feel really blessed to have the medical care that I have. And I think the fifth one would be, I'm going to add a fifth because I always add an extra one. When I went through my journey, I had a decent living, but then went to having no living and two children, and it was not easy. We made the decision to spend extra money paying for things that were out of pocket. And I believe that made a huge difference. And I know it's it's very hard. And there are a lot of people with this disease that have limited, limited budgets, but I have never felt like investing in my gym and showing up 3 times a week. People always say to me, oh, you belong to that gym. It's really expensive. And I always look at them and I say $960 a year on my health, if I'm showing up there 3 or 4 days a week, is never going to be expensive.
So knowing you as I do, you work, you have your family, you do the podcast, you're involved in more things than I can count on my fingers. How do you manage to do all that, Jill?
It's a good question. So I'm consistently overloading myself. I know that. I do feel like there was a point when I started feeling better, I stopped caring about the small stuff to some degree, you know, like, were the dishes all done and was my bed made when I left? And did I remember everyone's birthday? And I sort of canceled holidays for quite some time, and still today. I lost a lot of time in life. And some of this might be like PTSD. But I always, you know, there is so much time in our day. I think of doing Spondycast and some of the other work I do as that's non-professional work, but I think of it as like active recovery to a large extent. I always seem to make it through, and there's always room to like help out, right? And there are times when I can't and I'm a disaster and like I don't read the board packet as much as I should, I'll admit. And I fail every day, and I'm only looking for a B minus is my threshold for life. But I try to balance what's exciting and what's meaningful. And I say no to the right things, I think, most of the time. Sometimes, you know, I just fall off but yeah, it's not that hard. I also have built 20 some years of keeping, for the most part, I enjoy the constant travel and change, and I have my rituals that keep me grounded. I will say, I'll do a plug here for Hilton Hotels, right? Like I'm a Hilton person and an American Airlines person, because I know when I go to a hotel that's a Hilton, I know where the bananas are every day. And for some people, they want to have this like exotic meal when they travel constantly, or when they travel. I travel so much that I want to know things are in the same place everywhere I go in the world. And same with flying, but yeah, I mean, there's always time. There's always, I have started saying no to some things because you start to see if you spread yourself too thin, then what happens is you never make a big enough impact. And my professional work the last few years since I transitioned into data is really like, I look incessantly at, okay, if I'm going to make a commitment for 30 minutes this week or for 30 minutes a week, like this is the time and these are the no's I have to say. And I've started to do that because I think we do come to a point where in life you kind of have to like pick your lanes. And you know, I've really, obviously the work stuff, I have my head down a lot trying to run decided to start a startup at 47 with a chronic disease and like no experience as a SaaS data company. But I believe in what we're doing, right? And I think that fuels me a lot on the work side. I believe with every grain that if we can find a way to value people differently in the workplace and deliver the right arguments to the C-suite and the CFO, we can change the world. I believe it wholeheartedly. It's never easy. And then on the flip side, like on spondylitis, I get more excited and like motivated to continue to do more because I see what we've accomplished in just the 3 or 5 years I've been involved. All the work that the research, the changes, the people we've been able to reach. You know, one question you asked me earlier was like some of the standout moments. And some of those standout moments are that what fuels me is like when people call me and they say, or they reach out on LinkedIn and they say something like, I've listened to every episode and you've been with me every episode on my journey. And I was here and I'm here now. Or Bruce, I'm going to forget his name, last name. I interviewed him. We did the intubation when you have a fused spine, and the program that's gone out for paramedics and different medical professionals that it actually, right, his mother-in-law or father-in-law, I believe, was fatally injured because the people taking care of him didn't know to look for a fused spine. And after our episode, he reached out and told me that someone up in Canada had reached out and asked that they had a similar situation. And they wanted to start a program in Canada for their, the province they were in. So things like that. And I somehow managed to always get like 8 hours of sleep. Most of the time, I don't know. I actually don't know. I used it. My bio used to say that I was a multitasker of miracles.
Wonderful. We've talked a lot about the past. Let's talk for a moment about the future.
Okay.
So as Spondycast reaches its 100th episode milestone, what are your hopes for the future of the podcast? And what are your hopes for the spondylitis community as a whole? What do you see in the future?
Yeah, this is a really good question. This is the question I always ask, which is, what's your moonshot? So I think it's a couple of things. I think we all agree faster diagnosis is something and a cure. I was looking at stats today that showed it's 1 in 150 people globally. Like, it's a really costly, expensive disease that is, we need to address it, right? There's a huge need to address this disease and how we eradicate it. So that's one. I would, you know, let's just eradicate the disease. But I think we need to get research money flowing. One of the things I also think about a lot, and anyone who listens probably hears the through line of, how do we take more things that are research oriented and move them through the translational pipeline to become, whether it's commercial or productized, or how do we start taking this research and making it something that people can connect with every day? I think a lot about that. And so I might be throwing into my universe another startup. that's on my mind a lot. But like Michael Weissman and I talked about this 3 or 4 years ago, like, how do we take some of this stuff and we get it to where it is part of people's daily routines? So I would love to see that. I would love to figure out how we take pain from people, because pain is the hardest part. And that's on the research side. For Spondycast, I hope we get to keep doing it. I really hope we get to do another 100 episodes. I'm in, if you guys are in. And I think for it, you know, it's, we can't do it without the people who listen. And of course, our sponsor at AbbVie. But we can't keep going without people listening. And it's unfortunate that we have a captive audience who all has a disease. But I'm really hoping that we get more we are able to make the disease more visible to the general population. I think there's a huge opportunity there. And advocacy, man, policy, advocacy, and these insurance companies, we have got to do something. So that's a big one on my list that I've probably ignored more than I should have. So yeah, I think that's about it. And I mean, really, I mean, from the whole 100 episodes, I would be very remiss if I did not thank everyone at SAA, especially Jason and Melissa. And I know I'm missing a bunch on the programs team because you guys might not know this, but all I do is get on and ask questions. So I have the easy job and they do all the work behind the scenes and Jeff, of course. And I couldn't do that without them. I'm not this organized. So that's been really amazing. And listeners, I mean, I think the listeners, what I would love to see more from listeners is interactivity when we post new episodes and feedback or sharing stories or suggestions. There's one thing I've learned in startup land is the more people that share it, like it, tag it, the more of a difference you can make to proliferate it within the community and find sometimes the financial support for an organization like this that you need when you can go to donors and show them your numbers. What did I miss? Sorry, go ahead.
No, just because what you're on is a question I'd like to ask you.
Yeah.
What message would you like to share with the listeners who have been with you on this journey, this 100 podcast journey? What message would you like to share with them? What do you want to say to them?
Oh gosh, you threw a curveball. You weren't allowed to do that. I would like to say, like, first, thank you. And we hope that you, while we're seeing you on audio or we're you're listening on audio, like, I hope you feel like we see you and we hear you. I think the team does an impeccable job at curating like a variety of stuff, but if there are things we're missing, we'd love to know. And I think the other thing is, you know, listen, after all the last 10 years, my advice would be like, continue to find ways to connect with yourself, because I think that's how we connect with the larger world. And that, yes, hope can be a strategy. And it's mine most days.
Thank you. It's been a joy listening to you and having you share with us your experiences and your knowledge and your hope. So thank you so much for what you've done. And thank you in advance for what you're going to do into the future. It's been a joy, Jill.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. It's been great. Like, this is my favorite hour of the week. So I'm really grateful for this. It makes me better, like makes me feel better. It's very selfish. And that's a wrap. SpondyCast was made possible by donations from the Spondylitis Association of America's individual members and our show's corporate sponsor, AbbVie. Since our founding in 1983, the Spondylitis Association of America has been the face, voice, and leading nationwide nonprofit educating, empowering, and advocating for people living with spondyloarthritis. Through our extensive work with patients, the medical community, and partners, we provide information and resources to help people impacted by the disease live better lives and champion research to find a cure.